How do you sort of assess like that a technology is worth pursuing?
I think always focusing on the at hand and not getting swayed by trends and technology is one of the most important aspects.
What do you think the future role of the architect looks like?
I think having like a curious side to always investigate new technologies, new tools, new ways of doing things, and always the current processes by which you're doing things. I think that's a very important skill to build.
How companies like yours look into data ownership in the age of AI?
Just educating people about and what really happens when you're dragging and dropping some of those files there, mm-hmm. and who's like receiving this data, where it's going, where it's being stored, what it's being used for, I think is a very important thing moving forward to maintain this idea of data ownership.
Foster & Partners is one of the largest architectural companies in the world, and we were lucky enough to sit down with their applied research team to discuss innovation, AI, and tech implementation in architecture. You're listening to Bricks and Bytes, and on this episode, we welcome Sharif Tarabishi, Associate Partner of their Applied Research and Development Group. In this episode, we discuss how Foster & Partners automate their design and fabrication process, lessons from rolling out custom data interoperability across 45 projects and 2,000 staff, and why generative AI could make designers lazier and how you can mitigate this. If you're enjoying our podcast, you can support us by heading over to www.bricksbytes.show and signing up to our newsletter. This is an easy and free way which helps us keep the podcast going. In addition, you'll receive each of the key insights from the guests we have on, as well as some bonus content about what's going on in the wider world of construction tech. And now, an announcement from our sponsor, Shift. Worried you'll lag behind because construction's going digital and you struggle with all things tech? You need the right BIM partner to help. That's why this episode is brought to you by Shift, BIM specialist for contractors who want to thrive and stay competitive in construction's digital future. Visit makethesht.digital for more information.
So Sharif, before we have people on, we usually put a LinkedIn post out, and we put like a little bit about the guests coming on for the week and some questions. When you shared that post, it got like probably one of the most amount of likes on any post that I've ever put out, but no one actually asked a question. Mm-hmm. So you're obviously very liked, but everyone's scared to ask you anything. So my conclusion to that is you may be some kind of mafia boss or something.
I wouldn't be able to say in public, but no. It's an interesting take, actually. But also, like, most of the people who are following me are people I work with or students in the university, and I already participate in a lot of talks and conferences and so on. So yeah, I think if someone had a question to ask me, they already had a lot of opportunities to ask.
Yeah. Route of questions. So with that, Sharif, give us a little bit about who you are and kind of where you came from.
So I started back in Egypt, in Cairo. I studied architecture, engineering, and environmental design. Actually, I started first electronics engineering before I decided to switch.
What made you switch?
I got a little bit bored of the amount of physics and maths that I was studying. Little did I know that I would be using that maths now. Yeah. but it was an interesting switch. Then after I finished my bachelor there, I worked for a while in an architecture studio. And then I opened a consultancy with one of my tutors in the university, a digital consultancy for showing people how to integrate different technologies within their design to production workflows.
Which year was it?
That was around 2012. Mm-hmm. 2013 maybe, and it was one of such consultancies, one of the first in Egypt. It was an interesting time back there. Obviously, We worked for quite a while, but the market wasn't really ripe for this kind of interventions.
Mm-hmm. Too early.
Yeah. Interestingly, now also I see a difference between like how things are working here and there, and why here there is a lot of interest in integrating technology for profit margins of projects that might be very little compared to Egypt, where materials and labor might be extremely cheap and already contractors have very big profit margins. So there is very little interest in changing how things are done.
Yeah. Mm.
So there is no driving force to make things better in the market.
Mm-hmm. Here's the other way around, actually, right?
Here, the profit margins are low to a point that there is very big interest and money lying around to put in any technological advancements that would make you squeeze any efficiency out of your process. Yeah, so that was an interesting realization after I came here.
Mm-hmm.
I moved here to do my master's in architecture computation. And then I started working in the applied R&D team in Foster and Partners.
Mm-hmm. And now you're an associate partner and you're also a visiting lecturer at Bartlett School of Architecture. So it's been some kind of journey all the way from Egypt to to where you are now. Yeah, how was it transitioning from perhaps like traditional architecture to like more computational? Do you need like a certain kind of brain type to be able to do that? Because one in my head is a bit more like not creative but crafty, whereas the others is a bit more kind of technical and a bit more programmatic. Is that a word? I'm not sure.
I believe anyone can do it. I had interest in that area since my bachelor, like back in 2010, 2009 maybe. During summer, I was participating with a friend of mine in an architecture competition, and they had a requirement to do something with the facade of the building that we're designing. And they were like, hey, we've been seeing those kind of techniques and those kind of workflows using scripting. Can you have a look at this and let us know how we can integrate it in what we're doing? So I started like studying on my own. There wasn't really many opportunities or resources available online for this. I helped them do the implementation and the competition. And since then, I was very interested in this area. And directly after I finished my bachelor there, I also started teaching in the university and introduced those courses for introducing different scripting techniques and different technologies in the design workflow.
Mm-hmm. And that was like scripting techniques, you mean like coding?
Whether coding or visual or node-based coding like Grasshopper in Rhino.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Is there a difference between designing? I mean, obviously there is, but is there like a different way you approach things when you're designing things in somewhere like Egypt versus, I assume that you're working on projects in London, but Foster and Partners, where you work, is a global company. So.
My experience, lots of people in Egypt design overseas.
Yes. A lot of the projects I worked on while I was in Egypt were projects for the MENA region in general.
Yes.
Very few were international. But yeah, I don't think I saw a big jump in mentality or in process. I think once I came here, I fit in pretty well and fast within the team. And I think when you look at it from the point of view of the problems that you're trying to solve, you just have different inputs or different parameters that you might need to consider. But at the end of the day, the process is pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't feel a big jump or a big change.
You're still trying to get from A to B, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Applied researcher, Foster and Partners, what does that mean?
How does your day look like?
Usually very busy. So in Foster and Partners, the way the office is structured is very interesting. We have 6 design studios, and we have around 13 or 14 specialist teams or support teams that act as in-house consultants for those design studios. Specialists like landscape design team, urban design team, structure engineering team, and applied R&D is one of those teams. Historically, we've always been around 1% of the size of the company. The company now is around 2,000 people, and we're actually inching a little bit higher than 1% now. We're 24.
Not nice. Yeah.
2.2.
Yeah. And we work under three categories in a sense. Part of it is offering design support for the design teams when it comes to geometry optimization, detail extraction for fabrication, a lot of those aspects that we work in. I'll tell you a little bit about the six core capabilities that we do. And then another aspect is more related to developing tools. So from a lot of our interactions with the design team, sometimes we find that they are facing the same problems over and over again. Mm-hmm. And this is when we start formalizing the solution, in a sense, in a product that we can develop, deploy across the company, maintain and train people on so that they can use it on their own. And that's like another category of work that we do. And then the third is more research-based, which usually there is a strategy for the whole team where we want to go, but it's also bottom-up driven a bit based on the interests of the different people in the team. Across the team, we have people from different backgrounds with different interests, but the common thread between all of us is that we're all programmers. And interested in solving problems.
Not necessarily architects or engineers? Like
We have architects, we have structure engineers, we have artists. Wow. Yeah, so it's a pretty mixed bunch.
Andy Warhol there?
In terms of the six areas of research that we're interested in working in, one of them is machine learning and data science and data wrangling. Another aspect is geometry optimization for fabrication, high-performance computing, XR and VR, and collaborative tools that the designers use during their design process. So those are like six umbrellas that most of our products or our research work under.
That's a lot.
On the fabrication kind of working, do you basically work on like... Architects come up with like a very fancy curves and shapes, and then you help them achieve them within the software, so then they can come to for fabrication. Or
exactly, it depends when this happens across the design process. It might be early stage, and they know that okay, to fabricate this, it might be very expensive, so we need to rationalize it somehow or optimize it, depending on whether we know at this point in time what is the fabrication process that we're going to use. Or if it's in a later stage, then a lot of things might have already been known about the project, the fabrication technique, all of those things, and we might be optimizing things in terms of cost, for example, or in terms of making the fabrication more streamlined. So it's basically taking different constraints, whether from the designers, from the client, or from other stakeholders, like the fabricator, for example, and using those constraints to optimize or tweak the geometry to make it perform better.
Makes sense.
Okay, so these tools you're developing, this sounds to me, from what I understand, is that they're mostly for internal use. So one thing we're trying to explore on this podcast is kind of like use cases for technology that has been developed. But usually it's technology that is developed by a startup or someone and they're selling into a company like Foster & Partners or whoever else. So if Foster & Partners are creating this software, there's actually a use case because you're using it internally, then why is this software not made available to the wider market and perhaps not sold? But I don't know.
I mean, one aspect of it is definitely IP, right? Like any piece of development that we create in-house is part of what makes Foster & Partners Foster & Partners. And in a market that is based on competition, any edge that you have is something that gives you an edge in the market, basically. there are those discussions are happening internally, and a lot of people are interested in exploring the possibilities of what could happen if some of those tools might be opened up for the market. It's an ongoing process that we're exploring.
No, I just like, as some people we had on the podcast are advocates for open innovation. So it's like everyone should just share a thing and the industry would move together collectively. But I totally also understand the competition element. Like, it makes sense. We're in business.
Like,
right?
A dreamland kind of, right? Because,
yeah, communism.
And I mean, also personally, I believe any piece of, especially if we're speaking about software, any piece of software that we put in the public domain comes with a responsibility. And whether we want to take on that responsibility to not just be supporting our in-house projects, but also supporting all users who are interested in using this tool is not an easy task to... Mm.
Of course.
It's
like a separate business, right? Yeah. You need to have support and people who will babysit those who are using it, et cetera, right? So I think if you want to stay a great, great architect, you just stay a great architect.
Yes, true.
And I mean, a lot of the... again, given the type of projects that we do in Foster and Partners, there are a lot of bespoke things that happen in each single project. And it's not necessarily that a lot of the tools that we develop might be usable for any other types of offices that work in different typologies of projects. So I think it's also good, like, to keep in mind this aspect, that it's not necessarily that we create a tool internally, that there will be a use for it in the wide market, the wider market.
What about, is there an area within design stack that should be developed and explored more, broadly speaking, that it's not explored enough right now, or maybe within Foster Partners or generally?
Personally, I think the design aspect is explored a lot, and there might be a lot of inefficiencies around running a design business that might be more interesting to explore.
What would that be, for example?
I mean, if you go to any office and map the different processes that they are doing aside from the design work, there is a lot happening there to make the business a business.
Yeah.
And also at the same time, it's something that you don't get taught in architecture school, how to run a design, or in general in any creative-led industry.
Yeah.
Very few schools actually teach the business side of things. So, I think like across those processes, there are a lot of interest to do things.
So opportunities is in the workflow, you say?
Yeah.
Could you give us an example, Sheriff, of one technology that you have developed internally? And I think we were discussing before we started this about a software that came to our attention recently called Speckle, or even Rayon, where it allows a completely collaborative environment, so everyone's working on a single file as opposed to what is deemed as the standard, where it's like one file, architect does their bit, sends it to the engineer does their bit, and it's just very clunky and nothing's really happening in real time. So yeah, could you talk about
So Hermes is one of the in-house tools that we've been working on for years now, and it was basically that we identified a problem, like you're saying, the interoperability of data between different software that is usually used by different stakeholders in the project. And to try and fix that, we created Hermes, which is a message passing software that is living in the cloud and can communicate messages or transform messages from one software to Hermes language, let's say.
Is it Greek or?
Greek, yes. So, for example, in a recent project that we're working on, we identified that specific people within the team are going to be dealing with the grid lines from the project. So this team can say, I want to control the grid lines while I'm working in Revit. And whenever I finish using Hermes, I will publish to anyone interested that I updated my grid. So someone who's creating the facade in Rhino or in Grasshopper, and they build their own workflow based on the input of the grid lines, whenever a new message is available, they're able to pick it up and run that workflow in an automated way and get the results back.
So on this, if I can go a little bit further,
because
it does it not generate like lots of nodes that needs to be, that someone has to go through to pick up these messages? Because
of course, which is usually like the files that get scattered around your file system. But now it's versioned and controlled on the cloud. You know who authored it. You know the sequence by which things were pushed to the public or to the different stakeholders to build on. And you can also build your workflows on specific parts of it. So for example, after I create the facade in Rhino and I publish to everyone, hey, the facade is ready. If we have the environmental engineering team interested in running analyses, but on a simplified version of the geometry, not the heavy one, they can query that from my last message and automatically run their workflow and create reports based on my latest version of the facade.
Yeah, what I'm just thinking is like, because currently there's something similar that I came across, and there's like lots of notes, and the question is, a designer can get lost within all of this. So there will be, I think it will be very intuitive to have, I don't know how to phrase it really, but the latest up-to-date kind of information which summarizes everything above and just brings it down to like what is the latest.
But I mean, that is always happening, right? Because I can query the data from a specific task or a specific workflow, and I can always get the latest. But also in terms of auditing previous data, I can still do that. I can still go and see in the submission that we did in 15th of March, which messages were we using back then, and can I reconstruct how the project looked at during that time? And I should be able to do that very easily.
Okay.
What technology excites you the most?
I would say with the whole hype that is happening now around machine learning, there are a lot of aspects of it that excites me. Of course, like finding interesting domain applications, but also personally looking at people around us and how they are perceiving that technology and how they are using it to build things. I mean, we don't really in our generation get the opportunity that much to see such a massive adoption to a technology and be part of it. One aspect I've been interested about machine learning is the idea of intent and how it affects the intent of designers or creative people in general. If you look back in history to the different tools that we had, and you try and plot the progression of someone's skill versus their frustration while they are trying to deliver the intent that they have in their mind, as their skills get better, their frustration gets less, but they're also closer to the initial intent that they had in their mind. While with the introduction of
AI
and specifically like the generative based AI, suddenly now you have like a very steady line between skills and frustration. Regardless to your skills, you're able to generate something, but is it your initial intent or not? The fact that all the products that are coming out of the tool are polished in a sense, you can imagine how suddenly people can become just lazy and accepting to whatever it's creating. And like another interesting thing here to highlight as well, is that frustration that happens, it usually creates this idea of cognitive dissonance. Like, you have something in your mind, you have something in front of you, and they don't align. And this usually either leads to frustration or sometimes motivation. And this is usually when interesting things happen. like I would go and try a different medium. I would go and try a different technology. I would go and rephrase what the problem is or what I have in my mind. And I think the idea that suddenly we have a tool that minimizes the frustration, but not by making it easier for you to get what in your mind out, but rather just giving you something directly on the plate, mm-hmm. would be very interesting moving forward in the kind of data and artifacts that we generate in general.
I've used a few times the GPTs to generate some images for a house I was designing, and it just every time I generated an image, it was completely different. Yeah, so completely
and it
different.
Looked fine.
It looked fine, but it was completely something different than I was expecting. And I was thinking that I'm phrasing in the same way, added something, and it was just completely different building. So I think it's a long journey, at least for those general GPTs, to kind of get it right. Or perhaps I was making a mistake putting some stuff in
the We had an interesting installation in the recent open house that we had in the office where we were showing people an image of a Foster and Partners building, asking them to try and describe what they're seeing as if this is the idea that they have in their mind, and then looking, like evaluating objectively how close is the generated image to the image that we were showing them. I mean, again, it's not like a scientific study, but you can imagine in a context where you're stressed to deliver something, how faster you would be to just completely miss whatever you have in your mind and accept the polished thing and completely.
So what you're saying is you have an intention, you put it through the GPT thing, and the thing that comes out the other side might not be actually what you intended, but you just accept it because you're like that. Something's changed in your mind between
and previously, like the frustration that you would have would most of the time, if you're a creative person, would be the motivation to explore a lot of different things, and this variability is what the current models are building on.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So also another aspect you would imagine.
Do you mean on randomness?
Yeah, the variability of expression.
Mm-hmm.
If everything that we were feeding the models looked the same,
mm-hmm.
the models that we're using now for generative image generation wouldn't be as exciting as they are.
Interesting.
And again, if you take it up a notch, you can imagine in the future that like we have the first prototypes of cameras as artifacts in museums, you can imagine that it's not the models of today or the models that we're going to create in the future that will be worthy of putting in museums. It will rather be the pure data sets.
Hey guys, just a quick announcement. Throughout April, we're giving away a free sponsorship. This is a way for you to get in front of a highly niche and targeted audience. It will include podcast ads, social media ads, and newsletter ads. Visit our website, www.bricksbytes.show. That's www.bricksbytes.show, and hit the red button in the header to enter. Good luck.
That we collected before the point in time that those models started just generating stuff.
Oh, wow. Okay, this is getting quite deep.
I would prefer for generative AI to give me exactly what I'm thinking about, so I can then validate my thesis or do something with what I'm thinking about.
But do you really know what you're thinking about?
I do know.
Yeah.
This is an interesting
I think it's iteration, right? We want to iterate. We want the AI to give us faster, better iteration, right? So we can look at the details and tweak it and get some result very, very quickly. The next one closer, right?
This when is an I get interesting UX experiment that we can do, where we can get some people and have them using those kind of models versus models that, instead of giving you a very polished image, gives you a little bit of defined noise.
Mm-hmm.
And as you iterate over it, it will start getting closer to a final polished image, but it got, in a sense, the direction from you of what you want it to be.
Yes. Right?
Yeah, I would love to dive into that deeper, but we have some things to get through. In Foster and Partner, how hard is it to implement new technology? Obviously, a big company, 2,000 people, it's not going to be as quick as like a say 5 to 10 employee company. So is there a process that you guys follow?
I mean, for creating minimal viable products, which is something that we constantly do within our team, it's pretty straightforward. Once we find a need, once we identify a potential solution that we think might work, we get people working on it and create an MVP. If this is something we're using like for one project, that's it, because we can directly use it there and produce a result out of it. If it's something that we see might be beneficial for more people, then the process becomes a little bit different, where we have to consider a lot of aspects, security, IP, legal aspects, before we can deploy such a technology or such a product on wider teams.
Okay, and how do you sort of assess that a technology is worth pursuing? Does it say, like, we've had 50 people ask for this now, we need to do it? Or is it like, this might be cool, let's try it? Like, is there a kind of strategy?
I think always focusing on the problem at hand and not getting swayed by trends in technology is one of the most important aspects. Like, keeping the problem as your
friend.
Yes, yeah. As your guide.
Yeah,
it makes you look at things in a very strategic way, versus a lot of people who use technology for the sake of using technology.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, you will find yourself like just following trends, right?
From design point of view, like from maybe 10,000 feet view, what companies like yours struggle with from design point of view?
From a design point of view?
Yeah.
I think with the current tools that we have in the market, interoperability is definitely one of the biggest hurdles.
Mm-hmm.
Customization of tools.
Is Hermes internally solving the interoperability of?
Yes. We've been using Hermes in around 45 projects.
You said years. Oh my God.
45 big projects. Mm-hmm. And like having access to the code base and being able to tweak it as we go along based on the problems that the project is facing has been a very nice thing to have. I think also the idea of easily scaling up the tools based on the size of the projects that you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
The fact, like, the current way of software delivery limits you
mm-hmm.
in that. And I think in the future, tools that would allow you to scale up however you want in an easy manner are the ones people are going to lean towards more.
Mm-hmm. What about retention of knowledge? So if you have an employee who's been with the company for 30 years, they are absolutely brilliant at what they do. They've delivered a ton of projects, but they're leaving or they're moving on, right? And how does a company like yours retain this knowledge somehow? Or how can you think about retaining this knowledge in the future if there's no tools right now, for example? Like, what is the approach to that? Because no one wants it within their business to suddenly lose this pillar of a vertical within the business.
There are a lot of ways to tackle this. Couple that we've been working on, one of them is recently with the rise of large language models, we've been working on something we're calling FMP Ask, which is mm-hmm. basically a web app that allows different specialist teams within the office to contribute their knowledge bases. So we have a team like the technical design team who for 40 years has been curating different documents about our design guidelines,
mm-hmm.
What materials to use when, depending on the typology of the project, the location of the project.
Can you send me a PDF?
No.
I'm quite upset that you called it Ask. Was it Ask F&P? You didn't call it after a name of someone like Barry or.
We actually Claude. Had initially Claude. We had like an internal name called Arthur, who was one of the leads in the specifications team and was like the go-to person
That's his relic.
Yes. So with the tool now, those specialist teams are able to contribute those documents. And historically, those documents were very dense, so people weren't really... Like, they were still billing the teams for hours to answer the same questions over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So now, using those documents with FP Ask, like, the people are able to ask questions, get the results back, get the pages the results appeared in, be able to navigate directly to them. But also, we've been looking on the trust side. How can we build trust between the designers, the expert team, and the algorithms or the machine learning models that we're deploying? So we implemented like a review feature where it's like a human in the loop process where at any point someone asks a question that uses some documents that you own contributed, for example, you will get a notification telling you, hey, someone asked a question that used your documents, can you please verify it? So you're still able to stay in the loop, but asynchronously, freeing your time to do other stuff while still building trust with the users that the data is being verified. So that's one thing, for example. Another tool that we've been working on with collaboration with our management group and commercial group is looking at different fee proposals that we're issuing for projects and being able to build predictive models that can help them minimize risk from the fee proposal to the time that the project is delivered. And again, you can imagine something like this. It was always specific to, like, it was an easy task for people who have been in the office for a long time. They would be very easily, they would know what to do in terms of the structure of the fees. But for example, when you start onboarding people, and the idea of finding the right comparable projects historically, and where should we get that from? So the whole product is built on bubbling up the right information for those new people in the team to be able to take an informed decision at the right time.
Makes sense. What do you think the future role of the architect looks like? And maybe if you were a uni student right now, what would you where would you be putting your focus time on?
Move on to finance.
I think more technology oriented, but not necessarily enamored by it. I think having like a curious side to always investigate new technologies, new tools, new ways of doing things, and always questioning the current processes by which you're doing things. I think that's a very important skill to build while you're in university. How exactly will an architect role look like?
We will see. One knows.
Yeah.
No. We don't know what we don't know.
You're right. It's Martin's favorite saying.
Yes. So you previously were describing this tool that you have, this AI tool that is kind of gathering the knowledge, right? So I'm just curious, like, is it at the design stage? So is it in, within the software, like when you're trying to design something, then it's just popping out and telling you this information about what you're trying to do? Or is it not within the software layer, somewhere like a notepad kind of place that you have, and you have these notes? Because I feel like it would be very useful. Obviously, I don't know what you guys like working on there, but it would be very, very useful to have something during the design. When you're trying to design something, there is kind of something intelligently coming up and saying, oh, someone tried to did something similar, and that's how they did it, some prompt, etc., towards that.
Right now, it's not on the software level of mm-hmm. what the designers are using. It's like a separate
thing.
Scratch pad, let's say, on the right, yeah. where you're able to ask questions and get the answers back. Mm-hmm. But I see it developing in the future towards what you're saying. But for this to happen, mm-hmm. I think we need to look at how a lot of the data that we're creating is being collected.
Because you must have like at least 20 years of like IFC files, kind of, right? Right. So then if you can gather this in one thing, obviously do some AI on it.
Push a button. On it.
Yeah. And then
done.
And then make it work. Yeah.
Easy.
Yeah. It is, right? Yeah. Just GPT.
GPT. Yeah. The question is really like, how do you approach machine learning and gathering the data towards the future projects, and how can you aggregate the data that you already have for the last 20, 55 years?
I mean, the data already exists, and every day we're generating way more. Mm-hmm. And I think an interesting approach that we're taking is to try and map different processes within the office that we find interesting or can have a better way of being done. Look at the data that they are generating or they require to ingest in order to do that process, and look at how we can, from now moving forward, mm-hmm. record it in a way that is usable for us.
Yeah.
Once we see in that process that our MVP makes sense, it's a valid use case, mm-hmm. it's actually useful for people within the office, makes them more efficient, makes them take more informed decisions, that's when we start looking at the historical data. Mm-hmm. I think also, we're just discussing before we came here, that in the past couple of years, there's been a lot of hype about data mm-hmm. and data roles across organizations. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of money being poured to do holistic sweeps of how all our data should be structured, which a lot of times doesn't really lead to something of use, something a good return on investment that you mm-hmm. put in. And I think the better approach is the approach that we're currently taking, where you start incrementally finding the workflows that might be pressing mm-hmm. to completely shift or transform, mm-hmm. look at the data required by them, and incrementally solve this issue before looking at the 55 years of historical data. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. What excites me when I think about it, when you speak about it, is imagine, and as an architect, you get excited that whatever work you do today, tomorrow, next week, next month, it will be aggregated towards some intelligent data, which will be like increasing the value proposition of the company, really, because it is intelligence which will be kept not within a human, but within the database.
Yep. And making your day-to-day work as well
easier
and more enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask one question. I watched a video of Foster and Partners before I came, and there was this robot called Spot the Dog on there. I'm yet to see a Spot the Dog on any construction site, so have you seen it on a site before? And actually, the video, it was on a construction site, but there was no one working.
Because we were using Spot as part of the early adopters program. We were lucky to be one of the first architecture companies in the world to be part of that program. And the idea was to find interesting use cases using this technology. And the project that we were working on was basically looking at construction monitoring and how we can close the loop in automating the whole process. In terms of data capture on site, regularly comparing it to design intent represented in a BIM model, and generating automated reports to go to different stakeholders to take actions on. And given that it was the early model, there were very strict guidelines in terms of space that we need to keep around it. And of course, you know, in a construction site, seeing something like this, everyone was crazy, like to take selfies and so on. And I think this will keep happening until it becomes a reality on the construction site. It's not something that's going to happen tomorrow, but it's definitely something that's going to happen in the near future.
Yeah.
Data ownership, how companies like yours look into data ownership in the age of AI?
I think this is definitely a very important hot topic in terms of not just the data that, again, historical data and like the IP it represents, but also current data and educating everyone within the office about the current use of AI tools and how by submitting something on open source tools or cloud hosted tools, you might be breaking that without really knowing.
So that is going to decrease the speed of adoption of these platforms, right?
I don't believe so, at least in our office, because we've been working on developing different applications that are hosted on premises within our own infrastructure, screened by our legal team and our IT to make sure that our confidential project data is maintained and no one is breaching that. But I think the one of the interesting aspects about the current rise of machine learning and AI is that the model of software delivery is now completely different. Before, you had to go through IT if you had a setup in a big enterprise to whitelist a specific EXE that you need to install, while now everything is running on the cloud through APIs. You don't really need to install anything. It's one click away, and you're just dragging and dropping whatever data that you're using for the provider to consume. And just educating people about this difference and what really happens when you're dragging and dropping some of those files there and who's like receiving this data, where it's going, where it's being stored, what it's being used for, I think is a very important thing moving forward to maintain this idea of data ownership.
Sharif, so when people can find out more about you and Foster Partners?
When?
Where? Have I said when?
Tomorrow.
Okay, so when and where? Obviously, where.
My LinkedIn page. We also have the Foster and Partners website, and we have the Applied R&D page on the website.
It's a great page, by the way.
Where we always post about the recent things that we're working on.
And you're based in Battersea by the river.
We're based in Battersea by the river, yeah.
All right, Sheriff. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.